Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 23.
On today's show, we continue our Japanese language series with Alex from LearnJapanesePod.com. He talks to us about how being a musician helped him learn Japanese. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, we're going to continue our Japanese language series with special guest Alex Brook, who runs the podcast LearnJapanesePod.com. Alex has a really great podcast if you're interested in learning Japanese. And what I particularly like about his podcast is that he runs his podcast with the help of some special co-hosts who are all native Japanese speakers. So you get to hear from a native speaker exactly what the pronunciation is and how it's used in Japan here. And his show has produced over 100 episodes, 109 actually as of today. And I find it a really good resource for learning Japanese. And what I particularly found interesting is that Alex is a musician. So his study of the language comes from a very different background than most people, and certainly from mine, because I'm not musically inclined at all. But he looks at the tones and the melody and the flow of the language. And so it was really interesting talking to him to see kind of how he used his musical inclination to study Japanese. So we're going to be talking to him a little bit later on in the show. But first, I wanted to quickly mention the Tokyo 2012 Marathon, which happened today. Today is Sunday, the 26th of February. And this is a really great marathon. All sorts of funny characters enter the marathon, from serious hardcore marathoners to people who dress up in weird costumes. And none more so than local tech resident, Mr. Joseph Tame, who runs the website Tame Goes Wild. If you've heard of Joseph Tame before, you've probably seen his many of his I Run videos that he does, where he runs around Tokyo and you can follow along in real time his run. And then a few months ago, when Steve Jobs passed away, Joseph ran around Tokyo in the shape of an apple. So if you followed it on Google Maps, you could see his route, and it was in the shape of an apple. It's really kind of cool how he does it. And so for the Tokyo Marathon, he is running with what he calls his I Run gear. And what this thing is he's got all this technology strapped to his body. He's got iPhones, and he's got an iPad, and I believe this year he updated it with a MacBook Air, and all of this stuff live streams his run over the web. So if you're not so athletically inclined, and you want to enjoy the marathon, you can follow along and just watch his live stream. And it's actually a lot of fun because he has this crazy getup. He's got a satellite dish on his head and all sorts of cameras and all this stuff sticking out all over him. And so the Japanese audience, the people who are watching it, really get into it. So it's really kind of fun to watch his live stream and see the reaction from all the Japanese bystanders. So if you the marathon is over now, but I'm sure you can probably still view the stream online. And the best place to do that is on his Twitter account at Tame Goes Wild. Joining me for this week's Japan Blog News is Brad Stevenson from 25cafes.com. 25 Cafes is a travel guide to 100% smoke-free cafes in Japan, and Brad joins me today to bring us his latest review. Hey Brad, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Hey, nice to see you again.
You too. So what do you got for us this week?
Well, this week I'm going to talk about this cafe that I've personally been visiting for the last 6-7 years that I've been in Japan. It's called Bio Cafe, and it's right in the heart of Shibuya. So this place is really, really interesting. It's a very, very kind of European-inspired cafe on a street in Shibuya called Spain Dori, or Spain Street. It's right near like all the major shops like Zara, Body Shop, and Gap and the Disney Store down Spain Street. And it really is relaxing. It's 100% smoke-free and has a huge selection of organic, vegan, and vegetarian food.
Okay, so no meat at this restaurant, but mostly vegan and vegetarian food. What kind of food do they, like, what kind of stuff is on the menu?
Yeah, I was actually surprised because it is vegetarian, but me and my friends, like, whenever we've gone, we kind of don't even realize it's a vegetarian menu because they have such a huge variety of choices on the menu, such as your quiche. There's even kind of fake steak, like tofu steak and tofu turkey. There's like really nice selection of salads, really huge selection of soups, curries, and the thing that we loved the most was the bread. The bread is absolutely delicious. Yeah, the front of the cafe is actually kind of a small bakery that you can go into and like get takeout pastries. But I definitely recommend eating in, because pretty much when you order anything, you get like a free bowl of bread. And that sounds really, really cheap, and I'm not a cheap person at all. But this, the bread that they give you is like 6 or 7 different types of bread. Apparently it's inspired by French cuisine, but really, really delicious. Like, we ordered a main course in there as well as a few desserts and teas, and we really just kept asking them, like, more bread, bring more bread.
How is the veggie food taste? If people aren't into vegetarian food, how is the tofu burgers and all that? Does it taste pretty good?
It's really, really good. I've been there with a few carnivores and they loved it. Like, they're very much anti-vegetarian, anti-vegan, but they didn't miss it at all. Huh. It's not really a place where you go there and it's like, we have lettuce. It's they actually make it a very, very enjoyable experience. The main courses are fantastic. I recommend the quiche. The quiche I always get when I go there. It's a very big serving size with some fantastic organic vegetables on the plate as well. And the tea and beer selection is quite large. And you can hire this place out for private parties as well. But it does get very popular. It is one of the most popular cafes in Shibuya. So it's well worth ringing ahead, making a reservation on the phone. Or if you just decide to rock up out of spontaneity, probably expect to wait for about 5 to 15 minutes in the seating area at the door before you're given a seat. So it's really strange. I'm surprised they haven't opened another one, actually. But word of mouth really has started spreading about this place. And I really can't recommend it enough. If you're in Shibuya, you've done a busy day shopping, or even just like you're out with friends and you want to have something to eat before you go out to one of the nearby clubs, definitely give this place a look.
Sounds good. Well, if people want to find out more about the Bio Cafe, they can visit your website at 25cafes.com. And thanks, Brad. Thanks for joining us today.
No problem. See you later.
We are continuing our Japanese language series today with Alex Brook, who runs the website learnjapanesepod.com. On his website, he offers over 100 podcasts that are recorded with native Japanese speakers who teach useful everyday conversational Japanese. Hey, Alex, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks a lot.
So you also run a podcast as well.
I do. And let me bow in your general direction, Tokyo Podcast. I love it. It's a great podcast. I was like, I wish I had thought of that idea too, just talking about what's happening in Tokyo Podcast, but you did it. Awesome podcast. So from one podcaster to another, awesome job. Well done.
Well, you've been doing it a lot longer than I have because you have over 100 episodes on your website. And can you tell my audience how you got to Japan and how you got started on your website?
A long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I was a music student in London University. And along with my music studies, we also have language components. And I was a terrible student of languages. I was the guy who sat at the back of the class, you know, throwing pieces of paper at the students in front of me. And by the time I left secondary school, or what you would say in the States, high school, my French was terrible. And I actually felt quite embarrassed that I could barely speak one language, let alone two. So when I got to university, my main focus was music, but I also elected to do a language. Now, I didn't want to study French again because I'd already ruined that experience. I was looking at Italian, Chinese, Arabic, something very different. And my university offered Japanese, so I decided to try that for a year. It was a part-time course. And at the end of the year, I really, really enjoyed it. And they offered me the opportunity to become an exchange student. And my university had an exchange program with ICU University, International Christian University.
Okay.
And I came to Japan for the first time as an exchange student. And that was my first time in Japan as a student. And that was an absolutely fantastic year. I had a great time, made some great friends, had some really, really good Japanese teachers, and learned lots of Japanese. And at the end of the year, I didn't really want to leave. So I went back to London University, graduated, and then came back to Japan on the JET program. So that was my first foray into Japan as a student, and then the JET program.
When you first came to Japan, what was your language level like?
So I had done a part-time Japanese course for 1 year. I'd probably put in about, I don't know, it was about 2 hours of class time a week and then homework in the evenings. So it was not great. And again, I wasn't a great language student. I didn't really pick it up very quickly. But once I got to Japan, my Japanese was very basic and very textbook Japanese.
Right.
So, for example, I'd be, you know, asking questions like, "Tanaka-san, mo tabemashita ka?" You know, but then I talked to the guys I was living with in the dormitory, and these were kind of really, you know, rough and ready guys. They're all in the rugby team, and they're like, and they wouldn't say anything like that. They wouldn't say "mo tabemashita ka?" They would say "omae meshikutta."
Right.
I had no idea what that meant. So it was almost like having to relearn the language from scratch, and that was great. And I think traveling to Japan, making the friends, learning the real Japanese in the ramen restaurants, in the izakaya, stumbling home from Shinjuku at 3 a.m. in the morning was like, you know, the best place to learn Japanese for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how people who don't quite click in the classroom usually pick up the language, the colloquial language, quite easily.
Right. And I wouldn't say that. I think from long-suffering listeners to my podcast would know I'm definitely not the most, what's the word? My brain isn't the most organized of brains. I have quite an artistic side. I don't really organize things logically in my brain. I have more artistic way, I guess, of
right.
understanding the world. And the way we structured the podcast, we'll come to the podcast later, but partly the way I learned and partly the way Learn Japanese Pod has turned out is a very haphazard, random way of learning. We really didn't start with beginner's Japanese and then moving logically through a systemized approach. It was whatever we felt like learning on that day, whatever we happened to hear on that day. And that's really how I learned. It was a very random process, but that's how my brain works, and it was a fun way to learn. So it was successful to me. I wouldn't necessarily say it's good for anyone else, but that's how I did it.
Well, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people for Tokyo podcast and also for Bangkok podcast in regards to learning languages.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I kind of came to the conclusion was that everybody learns languages in a different way.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think the best option is just try to explore the different study ways that you have available
yes.
to you to find
yes.
one that works. Some people really do well in a classroom setting.
Sure.
We had another guest on Bangkok podcast who taught himself Thai just by moving into a Thai area and walking around with his dictionary in his hand.
No way.
And constantly asking everybody, you know, what's this mean? What's that mean? And what's interesting is that when he speaks Thai now,
right.
all the Thai people compliment him because he sounds like a Thai. He speaks very native style, casual, not foreigner style Thai at all, because that's what he learned.
That's real. That's the real kind of street
right.
Language approach. I really admire that and respect that. The few times I've been to Thailand, and I have a couple of friends in Bangkok, and they try to teach me a couple of phrases, and I blurt them out, and it ends with them laughing at me, basically. Thai, that's a hard language. But yeah, no, I totally agree. Like getting out there on the street, having real experiences and apply, even if you don't have that much language, say you don't have that much vocabulary or grammar or phraseology, just using what you know in a real situation really, really helps you to consolidate it in your brain. It's a real experience, you know.
Looking back now, because you've been in Japan for 17 years, correct?
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes.
So, long. Looking back now, were there any benefits to your creative right brain style of thinking to learning the language?
Were there any benefits in what you mean?
You're very creative. I noticed that you're also a musician.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look back now, I'm sure there's other musicians who are listening to this, other very creative people.
Yeah.
And maybe they're sitting in the classroom as well and they're like, nah, I just don't get it.
Yeah, so no. Yeah,
what would you say to them?
Yeah. for other people afflicted with a musical or artistic brain like me, I would say, yeah, the musical or artistic side is very useful for me. In fact, I used to teach English here in Japan, and I used to think of language in terms of rhythm and music. So when I was teaching English, I would stress the way that you use the rhythm in your speech, almost like a song. And it's also the same, especially when you're speaking in Osaka dialect. The feeling of like rhythm and musicality is much more apparent in Osaka then. At least I know that in my humble opinion, that's what I think. I don't know if people would agree with that, but Kanto ben is, you know, more like omoshiroi desu ne. It's more kind of flat, but in Osaka ben it's way more sing-songy and more rhythmical. And I think like my rhythmical training or musical training really, really helped me to understand the language in that way. Now, I do have friends who understand the language purely through the grammar. They just hit the textbooks. They can just, you know, absorb and soak up, you know, lists of vocabulary, and it totally works for them. But for me, thinking of it in terms of music, in a musical way, that's how I did it.
For me as well, I find, you know, kind of studying grammar wise, it just doesn't work well for me.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm from Canada and we were forced to study French for 5 years.
Right.
And I mean, how many of us remember anything when we graduate from high school?
Sure.
But you know, it's funny is if you listen to a French song long enough, you can recite the lyrics. You might not know what you're saying.
No,
but
absolutely.
Without even studying it at all.
Yes.
I'm sure everyone here has a foreign song in your iTunes list that you can sing along to without any study.
That's a fantastic way to learn a language, through music. I actually have a couple of Brazilian friends here in Tokyo, and I went around their place. We had a couple of caipirinhas too many. And I started to study a bit of Portuguese, and the most progress I made was through the music.
Right.
They'd sit me down and you know, they'd pull their hair out and sigh and get really annoyed with me that I just couldn't pick up. I couldn't conjugate a verb properly. But if you gave me a song, I could learn the whole song from beginning to end. These are famous songs everybody's heard, and it just gives you that framework to do it. So yeah, learning a language through music is such a great way to do it. And by the way, similar to your experience in Canada learning French, in England we learn French in secondary school. And I did a gap year in France for 6 months. I learned more French in that 6 months than I did in the 5 years previously to that.
And why
was that? That's because I was listening to French pop music and going out and buying my baguette in the morning. And, you know, it's got to be a real experience. And yeah, music is fantastic, definitely.
You know, I never really thought about that, but I wonder if you did move to Thailand, if your musical background would help, because Thai is a tonal language.
Yeah.
And that's one of the biggest things that foreigners struggle with.
Right.
Because unlike in English or in Japanese, the different tone that a word has can change the meaning of the word.
Right.
And for some of the words to us foreigners, they sound identical, completely the same.
Yes.
But to the Thais, they sound completely opposite.
And it's similar with Chinese, right? You know, ma,
right.
ma, you know, it's just something that we haven't had those neural pathways created in our brains. We just can't recognize it. It's probably the same frustration Japanese people feel when they're trying to pronounce R and L. It's so hard. I this may not be, well, maybe I think you can tell me more about this, but my friend in Thailand was trying to teach me the word for fish in Thai, and I'm gonna mispronounce this, and I apologize, but what is it, like blah?
Hang on a second, let me ask a Thai person. Thai person, come here. What's the word for fish in Thai?
Blah.
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 Low tone? Mid tone?
Blah.
Flat tone. Middle tone.
Blah. Blah.
Blah.
I mean, and I love the sound of Thai. It's just, it sounds like, you know, singing to me, like a, I don't know, it's very pretty, but you know. When
you want a real test?
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
This and this. Okay, say the word close, near.
Gai.
Say the word far.
Gai.
Can you hear the difference?
Okay, do it again, do it again.
One more time. This is close, like something is close to you.
Glai.
And this is far away, something's very far away.
Glai.
Can you believe that? I mean, it's so funny.
That's
two
really
words that have the complete opposite meaning sound almost the same. One is high tone and one is what? Low tone.
Oh, that's really hard.
And the thing is, if you're asking for directions in Thailand, you get that tone wrong or you hear it wrong, you think the guy said, you know, yes, the bank is close. And actually he said, no, the bank is far away.
and then you're really in trouble.
You're really in trouble.
You know, I always tend to think, you know, like Japanese does have its own challenging aspects. For example, reading and writing is really hard. But I tend to think that we get, you know, an easy ride with the pronunciation. I mean, my pronunciation isn't perfect, but,
right,
you know, it's very, I think it's quite simple. You know,
they
say, if you can say, please pass me two egg rolls, you've just enunciated all the vowels you need, you know, a, e, u, e, o. But yeah, Thai, I think so.
I agree, because I've heard some people here, no disrespect to them, but their accent is pretty interesting, let's say. And, but the Japanese are able to understand them quite well. Whereas in Thailand, there's people who've been there a while who still, you can mispronounce just one word. And it seems that the Thais can't get what you're saying based on the context of the sentence.
Right.
You think they would, but you don't understand that just one slight sound variation changes the word completely. And instead of saying, like, where's the bank, you're saying, my grandmother is an elephant or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, you make one mistake and you're not being given a glass of martini, you're being shown the door. So
it's
I actually, you know, in the future, I would like to attempt a tonal language such as, you know, Chinese or Thai. I have friends in Thailand, and I would actually love to learn, you know, basic survival Thai. But I have been quite daunted by the fact that there are tones. Growing up in London, I had a lot of friends from Hong Kong who spoke Cantonese Chinese, and you know, you hang out with them, you learn a few words, but they say, hey, come on, man, like, don't even try. you can't even get it. I believe, like, you know, Mandarin has four tones, and then Cantonese has what, something like seven. And it's all slang, so yeah.
Cantonese is much it's different, a lot different than
Mandarin, right?
Yeah, Mandarin is a very melodic.
Yes, yeah.
Is that melodic? Is that right? Like, very fluid language.
Ni hao ma.
Whereas Cantonese sounds a lot harsher to me. A lot more. How do you say? Strong and cutting almost.
You know, I've been to Chinatown in London many a time. I've had the delicious char siu ramen and the Peking duck, and I've probably heard hundreds of vowels of Cantonese being spoken in the background, and my brain just didn't pick up any of it.
Right.
Just none of it. So I'm one of those guys who, I'm not talented. I just have to rely on hard work. That's the only way I get to where I am.
Yeah, myself as well. I am envious of people who can pick up languages easily, because it just seems like such an amazing skill to have.
Right, yeah. It's,
and I wish I had.
Well, they're the annoying people I try to ignore. but yeah, no, I mean, really, at the end of the day, you know, you know, a lot of people ask me, so, you know, how do I improve my Japanese, or how do I improve my English, my Japanese friends? How do I learn a language? And my answer is, I have no idea, because as we discussed earlier, everybody learns language in, you know, such a different way. It's so such a personal thing, I think. And really, at the end of the day, what I've really come to believe is, before you ask, you know, how should I learn a language, you've really got to ask, like, why am I learning it? And when you identify that, and you've got your, you have that motivation for whatever reason, you know, you've got to do it for work, you just want to do it for traveling, you just love learning languages, or all of the above. Once you have that reason and that motivation, you'll find a way. I have friends who they'll sit down and just watch TV dramas, Japanese TV dramas, and they just absorb it like a sponge. I think that's a really good technique. It's not so good personally for me, but for other people, it's great. Again, other people will just, you know, they'll eat a grammar textbook and then come out speaking perfect Japanese. And to me, that's just incomprehensible. And vice versa, they'll look at me and say, well, what do you mean, you know, language is like music? We don't get you. So find the motivation, find out the reason, you know, what's the reason that you're studying the language, and you'll find a way. Trust me, I did.
Yeah, one of the things that I took away from all the people that I interviewed was that everybody has a different technique and a different method that works for them. Yes. But the one commonality that everybody had was they put in a lot of work into whatever technique that they were using to learn the language. Yes. You know, even it's a common belief that if you immerse yourself in a country or in a language, that you'll just pick it up through osmosis.
Yes, no.
And it's actually not true at all. You can live very comfortably in a country.
Yes, yes.
Full immersion, but not getting the language at all. It's very easy to live in an English environment here in Tokyo.
Absolutely.
Or in Bangkok. So even in a full immersive environment, you have to put in the effort and the work to learn the language. And that's where, like you mentioned, the motivation comes in. Without that, I think it's really hard to hit the textbooks or
whatever. I completely agree. And you know, another angle, this is just me, I used to be a bit of a kanji otaku, a kanji geek. And I just loved writing the kanji and, you know, knowing, you know, being able to write the kanji for geostationary orbit and all this kind of crazy stuff. And, you know, I would just study for hours and hours and hours like a big scary nerd in my room, writing the kanji out again and again and again. And today you could argue, you know, that wasn't really a very good use of my time. And now, of course, you don't need to write kanji because everything's on a computer. But just because I had that interest in the kanji, that was my doorway into Japanese, and that even actually helped my speaking too, because I could actually picture the kanji in my head and use it and test it out and use it in conversation and work out what was natural, what was strange. And a lot of people said to me, wow, you know, you must have spent hours daien desu ne Alexa. And I was like, well, no, not really. I mean, I enjoyed doing it because, I was a big nerd. These days, I don't really do that. I much more enjoy just going out and hanging out with my Japanese friends and, you know, shooting the breeze and talking about this and that and whatever in a noisy izakaya. And but yeah, you do have to put in the hours. But if you enjoy it, if it's what you're really into, it's not a problem at all.
And you know what? Another thing that I actually found for myself was that I find that when I first moved to Thailand and I started to kind of study the language a little bit, I found that learning the numbers was easy for me, and it got me used to speaking and hearing Thai. And what I found was that it sounds strange to learn, you know, 1 to 10, because most people, when they start the language, they learn usually greetings, konnichiwa, genki desu ka, stuff like that. But for me, most of my interaction in the beginning were with taxi drivers or the food lady, and I just really wanted to know how much I was being ripped off.
Yeah, right.
So it was actually good practice, because I would be able to ask them how much in Thai, and then they would tell me in Thai. So I could start to hear it. And what what really was good training for my ear was when they would tell me a number that I didn't already anticipate in my head. So I'd take a motorcycle taxi every day to work, and I know it'd be about, say, 20, 30 baht. Sure. But for some reason that day, it ended up being 40 baht. Well, I'm already waiting for him to say 30 baht in Thai. And he would say 40, and it would cause me, my brain, to instantly kind of search, like, what does that mean?
Right.
And I actually found that really helped in training my ear to listen to it and get me excited about moving on to, you know, greetings and other, the more other basic things.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting what you're saying, because I think there are many different techniques to learning language acquisition. And one of them is doing situational, you know, language. And what I've realized is that what we think are basic situations aren't necessarily basic language levels. So, you know, at the beginning of a textbook, you might have a greeting in Japanese, you know, hajimemashite, arikusumoshimasu, korekara yoroshikuonegaishimasu. You know, that's not easy stuff. And right. And then, like, just think about the situation. You're meeting someone and say, you know, you're a real beginner in the language and say, hello, nice to meet you, I'm Alex. And then someone says, oh, hey, it's great to meet you. So what do you think about Japan? You know, and you're like, these aren't, you know, what we consider a basic situation isn't necessarily a basic situation. So, like, basic language can be used in all kinds of, like, weird situations that you wouldn't think about before. So I really like your number technique. I think that's a really good way to do it.
Yeah, I was surprised how well that worked for me. And I recommend anyone else is, if you're starting a language, find something that you just kind of pick up.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I remember in Thailand, I used to teach English to a lot of Japanese salarymen. And they were bored out of their minds. Their company sent them there. They didn't care at all. And I would tell them, I say, like, look, if you're interested in golf, why don't you memorize the vocabulary for golf?
Yeah.
And they would tell me, like, well, they're never going to use it in business. Yeah. And I said, like, well, you're never going to use, you know, hello, my name is Sato either.
Exactly.
You
know?
So you might as well learn something that you at least enjoy and are interested in. And then if that sparks your interest enough, you can continue, you know, going into the more difficult parts of it.
I think this might sound like a completely obvious point, and in a way it is, but I think it's really worth saying that it's got to be fun, because you could have the best textbook in the world, but if you're not into it, you're not going to learn anything. And I think the people I've met who, like, study Japanese, I think many of them have the right idea. You know, they come into Japanese from many different angles. I guess I'm kind of weird in the Japanese learning fraternity, because I was just a language nerd. I love learning languages. But these days, you know, people might come into it because they're interested in manga or anime or cosplay or something to do with modern mass media, kind of masukomi. And I think that's a really good way to do it. So, you know, maybe they're learning Japanese so that they can understand their favorite manga. And I think that's the best way to do it. Whereas in Japan, I think, you know, English has really been turned into this TOEIC test of torture. And I think, you know, the Japanese, this is where I, you know, rail against the Japanese education system, but I think there is a tendency to, you know, have turned English into just a big test, and people do it because they feel that they have to. And once you're in that mindset, I think you're not going to make any progress at all. So finding, it's an obvious point, but again, it's worth saying, you know, finding what you're really interested in is the key, I think, to learning a language. So, you know, I used to watch period dramas, you know, Mito Komon, or these, what they call taiga drama. So these are, you know, Edo period dramas of samurai running around cutting each other's heads off, which I found very exciting and interesting. And that's how I learned a lot of Japanese. A lot of it wasn't useful because it's, you know, 17th century Japanese, but it piqued my interest and it made me more curious. Now, how do you say that? How would you say that now in modern Japanese? I'd go and look it up and try and study it.
Now, tell us about the podcast that you have on your website. You you have a podcast with a native speaker co-host.
Yes,
is that correct?
Yes. So we started the podcast back in October 2005, And we originally started the podcast when I was living down in Osaka with the first co-host, or I should say sensei, which was Beb. And if you listen to the first couple of podcasts, it's all in Osaka, man. It's all Osaka dialect. And Beb was a friend of mine who I used to gig with in Osaka. And then throughout the years, we've had different hosts, and we gravitated more towards Kanto. And we basically have 110 podcasts, which are lessons. And then we also have what's called Fun Fridays, which were weekly podcasts where we put down our Japanese textbooks and we just talked about life in Japan, what we'd been doing recently and things like that. So there was the lesson, and then there's the culture lesson, so to speak. And we've done that off and on for 5 years now. And what we're planning to do now is I'm rearranging the site at the moment, and we're reformatting the podcast and reformatting the entire site. And I'm getting lots of angry emails from people saying, where have the podcasts gone? But just to say to anyone who's listening, they're going to be back really soon. We're just reformatting the site, and we're going to open a new membership area where we're going to be doing specific courses for business Japanese, or Japanese for the classroom, or Japanese for traveling in Japan. And we're going to do these specific classes. We're also going to start doing more video, which we're really looking forward to doing, because all of our, basically 99% of our podcasts are audio, but we really want to start doing video now. So that's fun, exciting stuff, which I won't give away too much now, but basically within the next month, that's going to be coming out. So expect some big changes soon. So please check it out.
I'm curious to listen to number 46, which is shouting at old ladies in Japanese.
So that podcast was inspired by a time I was on a bike, and I was cycling along the river in Osaka and in my old house, and a woman on bike just plowed right into my side and just sent me flying. And when I came to, let's just say there was a lot of very fruity and very descriptive Japanese being hurled in my direction and back at them too. So I got home, gathered myself together, and just tried to remember what had been said. So these are kind of epithets and curse words. They're not too rude, but definitely Japanese you could use when you're very angry. And we always put a safety warning at the beginning of those episodes, saying that, look, we teach this kind of Japanese so that you can understand it, but we advise against you using it. We don't want you to get into a fight or anything.
But it's convenient to have, just in case, you know, you gotta let loose on that old lady.
Oh yeah. That was a.
Or at least understand what they're saying to you.
Exactly. And it's really interesting. I actually had a really good friend who, now he was one of these annoying people who was, he was just gifted with languages. This guy, he lived in, American friend of mine, he lived in Osaka for a year. That was his first time in Japan. At the end of that year, he was speaking fluent Osaka dialect. Wow. This guy, I mean, he's just really, really talented. And one day we went out drinking, and this salaryman, he was just completely drunk, like bumped into my friend, and my friend said, oh, sorry. And then this Japanese guy just started shouting at him. And this was in Tokyo. And my friend, he just unleashed his Yakuza Osaka band. And it was amazing. The salaryman, he just shrank in size and ran away. It was like, wow. I want those Jedi techniques too. It was incredible. It's interesting because, you know, English has some very descriptive swear words. We have quite a lot.
Right. Japan doesn't have very many.
They don't. And that's the thing is, like, you know, when I came to Japan for the first time, you know, of course, I was like, come on, tell me the really dirty words. And, you know, when someone's like starting a fight in England, you know, they're going to be using pretty fruity language, should we say. But in Japan, that, you know, they'll just say something like, oh my, worry. It's like, no, you are bad.
Oh, right.
You are bad. No, you are the worst. And then, you know, fists are flying, like, oh, right. No way, dude. You said you were bad. no, yeah. He said, then he said I was wrong. It's like, what an insult.
So, you know what's interesting is there's a gentleman named Stu J. Raj.
Okay.
And he's quite popular in Thailand. He's quite a famous polyglot. He speaks, I believe, 18 or 20 languages. And I believe he's from Indonesia originally. But he was asked once, what is your favorite language to be angry in? And he said it's Thai.
No way.
Because Thais have a huge arsenal of curse words. And it's really funny, actually, because sometimes Thais will ask me, how do we say something really bad in English?
Right.
I just hate this person. I want to say something really bad at them.
Right.
And I'll tell them, I don't know, I'll just say F you or something like that. And they're like, no, that's not enough. I want something like even more than that. And I was like, look, if you tell a big foreigner to F off, I mean, he's going to be pretty upset. And they're like, what? That's it? In Thai, I can curse his grandmother and his ancestors and his dog and his pet and his cats and his sisters and everything.
Right, that's it. You've sold me on Thai. Thai is the next language
I'm learning. It's really funny.
Yeah, that's it. I'm learning Thai next, definitely.
Japan is such a funny language that, you know, you get these people angry like, hey, you're wrong. No, you're wrong. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my Japanese friends was saying, like, what's the worst thing you can say to a woman? And I was describing, you know, some of, you know, like the sexist language, you know, you can use and the words that you should never, ever, ever say as a guy to a woman, right? And then I said, well, what about Japanese? And my friend of mine, she thought for a minute and she said, yeah, the worst thing you could say to a woman is, oh, yeah, you're fat. Like, oh, you're taking the gloves off there now. You know, I was like, wow, that's. I mean, those are fighting words. It's like you're fat. It's like, whoa.
Well, before we alienate our audience completely. Something else I wanted to talk about on your website that I enjoy a lot is your newsletter.
Thank you very much.
And as a matter of fact, one of my favorite recent interviews with Sachiko Takao-san came from reading your newsletter. I read your newsletter and the article you did on Sachiko.
Awesome.
I contacted her and we had a fantastic show.
Awesome,
and
yes.
So can you tell us a bit more about your newsletter?
Certainly. Oh, and by the way, a big shout out to Sachi. If you haven't heard of her, she's just absolutely awesome, cycling across Japan, eating all the food there is. I wish I had thought of that, but hey.
She is a dynamo.
She's just fantastic. She's really awesome. Go check her out. For the newsletter is a newsletter about learning Japanese, events happening in Japan, and it comes out every 2 months. So we're publishing 6 times a year. So it's January, February, March, April, May, June. The next one's coming out soon in March. The way to get your hands on it is just come to the website and just sign up. It's completely free, and we will send it to your email. Or if you check out the podcast feed, we actually put the PDF on the feed a couple of months after we've published it, so you can get it immediately if you sign up to our website, or get it a couple of months later on the feed. So yeah, check it out. And if there's anything you'd like to see in particular in the magazine, tell me and I'll write about it.
Well, I think people can get more information on that through your latest newsletter,
check
right?
It out,
most recent
check
one.
It out. Yeah.
They can find all that information at learnjapanesepod.com. Also, check out the over 100 podcasts that are available. And when do you think you'll launch your new membership system?
Yeah, we're going to be at the moment. We have the basic membership, completely free, no money, free forever. But the new members area will be opening up within probably end of March, I think. So please come along, check it out. We're going to have new awesome lessons. We're going to have videos. We're going to have reading, writing, speaking courses, business Japanese courses, all kinds of things. So come check it out.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Alex. Thanks for coming on Tokyo Podcast.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. And 皆さん、日本語頑張ってください。
Thanks again to Alex for coming on the show. If you are interested in checking out his podcast, visit his website at learnjapanesepod.com and make sure you sign up for his monthly newsletter. I find it to be a really good source of information about stuff that's going on here in Japan. The latest one covers the ski resorts here in Japan. And, you know, I don't think Japan is really kind of known as a ski destination, but it really should be because there is some really great powder skiing available here. That old kind of image you have of like outdated equipment and, you know, hour-long lineups is not really accurate anymore. Japan has really become a top-notch ski destination. And, I mean, I know I come from Whistler Blackcomb where I used to ski there all the time. So to come to Japan and enjoy this really nice powder snow is a nice welcome change. So if you're interested in checking that out, visit Alex's website. And if you're interested in the Veggie Cafe, the Bio Cafe, or any other smoke-free cafes here in Japan, visit Brad's website at 25cafes.com. And as usual, I will post a link to all these sites and all the other sites that we mentioned on the show today on my website at tokyopodcast.com. Don't forget to visit my Facebook page at facebook.com/TokyoPodcast. And if you have any feedback or comments on the show, feel free to send me a message on Twitter @TokyoPodcast. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.